Australian True Crime is an independent podcast. If you help us, we can continue creating and improving our content. That's our promise to you. To support us, simply hit the follow button on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This will help us grow and ensure you're notified as soon as a new episode is released.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Scott was standing beside the backhoe and he called me over and I could see the look on his face that, there was something of significance. And then when I went over and saw the ground that had been dug up, I'd seen enough bodies buried to realise that it was a human skeleton.
Gary Jubelin is arguably Australia's highest profile former detective right now. It's a spot usually reserved for former detectives on trial or former detectives becoming charismatic media commentators. But I'm pretty sure this is the first time one man has been both at once. Jubelin worked in major homicide for decades, investigating dozens and dozens of murders. Some investigations had satisfactory outcomes and some didn't, but it's the disappearance of 4-year-old William Tyrrell that brought his brilliant career undone. He was suddenly and sensationally stood down as the lead investigator on that case in May 2019. He resigned from New South Wales Police a couple of days later and was then charged with 4 counts of unlawfully recording conversations with the Tyrrell family's neighbour, Paul Savage, without a warrant. The public was outraged. In fact, over 17,000 people signed a change.org petition demanding the New South Wales DPP drop all charges against Gary Jubelin. The petition itself was started by the mother of a homicide victim. But the case went ahead and Jubelin was found guilty on April 6, 2020 and fined $10,000. He joined News Corp as an investigative journalist and he released a podcast called I Catch Killers. Then his book of the same name hit the shelves. I Catch Killers is one of the all-time great titles, obviously, but in a lot of ways, I reckon it sells Gary Jubelin a bit short because he's way more generous than that. The podcast isn't even about him catching killers at all. It's a show in which he interviews other coppers about their careers and their accomplishments. And the book is focused at all times on the contributions other people have made to his life and his work, and on the victims of the crimes he's worked on and their families. So I wasn't surprised to see so many of those family members gathered at Sydney's Downing Centre courts in support of Gary Jubelin during his trial. Two of our former guests, Mark and Faye Leveson, led the statements to the media outside.
This is from Faye and I regarding today's situation. We must start by saying what loyal supporters we are of decent, hard-working police officers and not ones who are driven by ambition and petty jealousies. That is why we stand here today, with our support right behind Gary Jubelin, a former police officer who will work hard, push the boundaries, think outside the square, and very importantly, consider the victims of crime always. Gary knew how to use all the resources at his disposal, including the media. We feel that his success and high profile have embarrassed and upset a number of overambitious superiors who placed their own careers before the task they were sworn to do. Gary is not just a huge loss to the New South Wales Police Force, but far more importantly, to the victims with whom he interacts and also the people of New South Wales. All of you in front of us now have massively more knowledge on police investigations and court matters than we do. We have got a question for you all. Do any of you here know if the current head of homicide and Gary's former boss has ever been involved in an active murder investigation? I've gone to Google and can find nothing.
Mark and Faye Leveson joined us in episode 76 of Australian True Crime, called The Unsatisfactory Case of Matthew Leveson. Matthew was their 20-year-old son who disappeared in 2007 after leaving a Sydney nightclub. At 3:20 a.m, Matthew texted a friend about an argument he was having with his live-in partner, Michael Atkins, who was 45 years old at the time. Approximately 9 hours later, CCTV cameras captured Michael Atkins at Bunnings, buying a mattock and duct tape.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
We'll check in with Mark and Faye Leveson a bit later in the show, but first, we hear from Gary Jubelin, who entered their lives 6 years after their son Matthew vanished, 4 years after his former boyfriend Michael Atkins had been acquitted of his murder. But at that stage, Mark and Faye still had no idea where their son's remains were, and they were very frustrated with New South Wales Police. I know they wanted Gary on their case, but I wondered when Gary first became aware of them.
I think I first became aware of it, and I've been in homicide that long. Like, when I say become aware of it, I'm familiar with a lot of cases that I haven't worked on that other people were working on. I had a vague recollection about that particular case when it occurred, but I think around 2013, after Michael Atkins was acquitted of the murder of Matthew Leveson, Mark and Faye came into the homicide office to meet with the commander, and I was invited into the meeting on the basis that I was familiar with the double jeopardy legislation because of my work on the Bowerville investigation, and they wanted the investigation to be re-looked at. Now, in New South Wales, if someone had been acquitted of murder up until the legislation was changed, there was nothing you could do. It was they literally got away with murder. But when the double jeopardy legislation came in, if there was fresh and compelling evidence available, that created the opportunity that an investigation could be looked at again. So Mark and Faye, the first time I met Mark and Faye was in the conference room at the homicide office, where they came in and sat down with Mick Willing. I think there was another inspector from Unsolved Homicide, and looking at the possibility of reinvestigating Matt's disappearance. I wasn't involved in it. I was privy to the meeting because of my expertise in the double jeopardy legislation and offered some input there. Then I took some time off from the police. I lived over in Western Australia for 12 months and just took some long service leave and whatnot. When I got back, the investigation hadn't progressed, and I had come back over strength to the Unsolved Homicide Squad, and I had a look at the brief, and I was a little bit frustrated that things hadn't been done, so I picked it up and started working with it with a couple of local area command detectives and one from Unsolved Homicide.
What do you mean when you say things hadn't been done? What did you think was lacking?
Oh, it hadn't been progressed at all. The investigation from when I was speaking to the family 12 months before, no one had picked it up. And, you know, I don't know the reason because, as I said, I was off for 12 months. I'm assuming it was a workload of other officers, but no one had actually had a look at this potentially fresh and compelling evidence. So I got myself involved in it that way.
So Matt went missing in 07. Atkins was charged in 08 but acquitted already in 09.
Yep.
So it must have seemed to a lot of people as though it was done and dusted. And as you say, because of the double jeopardy laws, there was an opportunity if there was fresh and compelling evidence. What was it?
The information that we'd received, that there was some comments made on social media, on Facebook, that appeared to be coming from Michael Atkins. And it was a private conversation that someone had passed on to onto police. We looked at it and examined it, and it certainly had information that was very specific that one would assume that only Michael Atkins would be aware of. On that basis, we followed up that information, which took us overseas at one stage, and then we had someone come back into the country and we followed it up. And it brought it to a conclusion that it was, in fact, someone that was pretending to be Michael Atkins had initiated the account. So that was devastating for us because the nature of the information, I said to Mark and Faye, Matt's parents, look, if we can corroborate this, I think, in my opinion, this does constitute fresh and compelling evidence. And I think there's a very real chance that we might be able to get the matter back before the court. That wasn't offering up false hope. That was just giving them my opinion of the information. So we worked on that for about 4 months. And then we thought we made progress. We thought we'd corroborated the evidence. And then there was a little twist right at the end when we realised, and I'll call him a nut, and I think that's an apt way of describing him, a nut had impersonated Michael Atkins and created this false account. And we tracked him down, and I was devastated for Mark and Faye because their hopes, whether real or imagined, had been lifted the fact that we're looking at it. So we're then confronted with a situation. I had two local area detectives from Miranda working on the investigation. One of them was Scott Craddock, another one Damien. And I said to those guys, look, because we were devastated, I remember going around to Mark and Faye's place and saying, I'm sorry, this information that we've been following up has come to a dead end, and what we've got here is there's nothing further we can do on the investigation. With that, Mark and Faye were very emotional, understandably so, and that was anger, sadness, the full range of emotions. And I walked out of their place feeling very, very down. And I felt like I'd given them false hope and then taken it away from them. And I could feel their pain. And so I had a lot of things going on at work at the time. And I said to Scott Craddock, who a great detective who eventually came and worked in homicide with me, I said, look, I can stir things up and we can see if we can progress this, but I haven't got the energy to battle this on my own. He wasn't at homicide at the time. I said, can you give me a commitment? Because I'll be doing this in addition to other investigations that we were working on. And he was 100% behind that. So on the back of that, I went and spoke to Mark and Faye and said, look, I don't know if this will progress it, but I have an idea here. What if we refer it to the coroner? And in the fact that the role of the coroner is determined the manner and cause of death. At this stage, you've put your faith in the criminal court, being the murder trial, and a person was acquitted, so you don't know what happened to Matt. They then they sent a letter to the coroner. I met with the coroner. I believe it was the state coroner at the time was Michael Barnes, and I put the proposal to him. Could we hold an inquest? And he said, look, it's unusual. And I said, well, the families have put their faith in the justice system and they still don't know what's happened to their son. Surely it's appropriate that it goes to inquest.
What was unusual about it?
It's unusual when someone's been acquitted of murder, that's the end of the investigation. What we were saying, or what the family, and I'm articulating the family's view on this, was the fact that they still have not got answers for what happened to their son. Their son disappeared. Someone was charged with murder and was acquitted, and they're still looking for answers.
So usually a family's out of options once that's happened, are they?
Yeah. It's rare that you go back to inquest after a murder trial, whether it leads to a conviction or acquittal. So it was sort of a new way of approaching it. On the back of that, the coroner was receptive to it, and then we started to prepare a brief of evidence, which involved myself and the team I was working with, Damien, Scott and John, to compile a brief of evidence to the coroner. And then we presented that brief to the coroner. And then during the inquest, Michael Atkins was called as a witness, and I discussed with Mark and Faye and also the Crown prosecutors on the best way to approach it. And what I would call a very novel approach, that Michael Atkins was offered a Section 61 certificate. Now, a Section 61 certificate in layman's terms is if you get in the witness box at the coroner's court and let's say it's on the peripheral, someone gets in the witness box and says, I don't want to answer the questions because it'll incriminate myself. The Section 61 certificate gives a protection for that person that anything they say that is related to a criminal matter can't be used against them, if you understand what I mean. So,
yeah. Indemnity. So, in fact, this was the first time that he had ever testified in this matter, wasn't it? So this is 2016, I believe. So this is nine years after Matt had been missing.
Yeah. So 2016. So Michael Atkins, and he had legal representation, and he was going to, in the witness box, anticipated that he would say he's not going to answer any questions, which is his right. Yeah, there is a right there. It's not a criticism of him or his legal team by any imagination. Is that he's not prepared to answer the questions on the grounds that it may incriminate him. And on the back of that, we've had in discussions with the prosecutor and discussions with Mark and Faye Leveson and Matt's brothers on the possibility of offering Michael Atkins a Section 61 certificate. And how that came about, I was speaking to Mark and Faye and said, what do you hope to achieve from this inquest? And this is where it gets very raw, and parents shouldn't have to make a decision like this, but what do you want to achieve? And they said, we want justice for Matt, which is tick, and we want to recover his body, bearing in mind they hadn't found Matt's body for 10 years.
And also that they had themselves been digging sometimes with their bare hands, hadn't they, in the bush looking for their son's body.
Yeah, now, look, that takes us on a different part, but I think it's probably appropriate at this point in time that to understand the pain and suffering that not just Mark and Faye go through, but anyone that loses a loved one, they would go to the national park down south of Sydney and just take a mattock and a shovel and search for Matt's remains. And, yeah, I can't even fathom to think of the pain they must be going through on that. So, obviously, a loved one, they wanted to bring Matt home. So putting to them, they said two things. They wanted justice, and that means the person responsible for Matt's death put before the courts. Then they also wanted Matt's body recovered. In further conversations, I said, okay, let's break it down even further. If you could only achieve one, and they've said, we want Matt's body back. And then that's when we started having discussions about the possibility of giving indemnity to Michael Atkins with the view of anything he says in the witness box can't be used against him. And that resulted in Michael Atkins speaking to us, speaking to the police and showing us where he believed Matt's body was buried.
Did you yourself take that drive with him?
Yes, how it played out, and there was a lot of negotiations backwards and forwards, and quite rightly so, because it was a big decision, and there had to be agreements in place, and his legal team certainly looked after his interests. But I sat down with him to interview him about it when it was decided that he would reveal what he knows about Matt's death, and his indemnity was subject to us recovering Matt's body. And I think we finished interviewing him about 2 o'clock in the morning, and then we drove with his legal team and myself and Scott Craddock, we drove in the police car down to the Royal National Park, and Mr. Atkins identified the area where he believed that he had buried Matt, and it was quite chilling walking around there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and with someone walking around in the bush trying to remember where he buried someone 10 years before.
What sort of conversation did you have in the car? Did he talk at all? Was he quiet in the car?
He was quiet, and it was certainly part of the strategy from the police point of view, is that it was difficult for all, and I'm not saying I've got sympathy for Mr. Atkins, given what he put Matt's family through, but it was important that there was an environment in which he felt comfortable that he could tell. So it was an awkward trip, it was an eerie trip, and it was certainly a strange situation that we all found ourselves in.
Because by that stage it was his contention, wasn't it, that Matt had died accidentally of an overdose and that he had panicked and buried Matt's remains in that location.
Yeah. That's the version of events that he provided during the course of when I interviewed him that night at his solicitor's office.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It was really hard going in that Mark and Faye were down there with us the whole time watching. And, yeah, we spent 6 weeks in total digging up the national park. And it wasn't, and this might sound strange, but it wasn't until the last hour of the last day of the search where I was actually speaking to Scott Craddock, my offsider, and our conversation went along the lines of, well, what do we do now? Like, we believe him. We think he's telling us the truth, but we have searched this, not just this location, another location that there was a possibility, given his recollection and some significant things he'd identified. And we dug it up, and then it came down to about the last hour, and that's when Scott was standing beside the backhoe that was digging, and he called me over, and I could see the look on his face that there was something of significance. And then when I went over and saw the ground that had been dug up, I'd seen enough bodies buried to realise that it was a human skeleton. And I looked over at Mark and Faye, and it's still to this day, it's pretty raw. I looked over to them, and I think they could tell on my face that we had found that.
Yeah, that's the way they describe it. They talk about seeing a fern, a large fern. And in fact, Mark saying to Faye, that would look great in our garden.
Yeah.
And then the search was coming to an end and they were despondent.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, yes, someone called you over and then they could tell.
Yeah.
From the look on your face, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty chilling.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, look, it was spending 6 weeks with the family while you got police combing the ground, digging up and looking for their son's remains. Full credit to Mark and Faye to come through the whole process. But, yeah, it was tough.
Yeah, but this is why they speak so highly of you, because you were the game changer. You were the person who, and that's what it takes so often when we're dealing with any kind of huge establishment like the police force. You need that one person to say, I'm going to take responsibility for this. I'm going to take you on board. I'm going to take your case.
Yeah.
and turn it around. And you were that guy, and you and your team made it happen after 10 years of them feeling sort of left on their own.
Yeah. I'm of the view, and yeah, some people might have differing views, but quite frankly, I don't care, because this is my view on the way homicide should be approached. You need to take it personal. You need to get involved. You need to get invested. You need to understand the pain that the victims are going through. And in an organisation, sometimes they don't want that type of thing. It's more of a statistical basis, but. And the advice I give any young police officer, and it doesn't have to be a homicide, any crime, care for the victims, have empathy for the victims, and be passionate about what you do. And there's a fine line, because it needs passion with perspective. Resources are limited. You can't waste resources or just keep banging your head up against a brick wall. But if there's something that needs to be pursued, what I often say is, how would you like your family to be treated by police? And I think that's a good benchmark on the way the police should approach things, is treat the victims the way that you would expect your family to be treated.
It is draining, though. It's a massive responsibility. I know retired homicide detectives in their 60s and 70s who are still phoned once a month by victims' families who don't have answers and don't have closure yet.
Yeah.
And you certainly left the force so suddenly. I'm sure you were in the middle of cases. Are you in the middle of things with families?
Yeah, and that's been my frustration, and part of it was that before I left the police, I wanted to do handovers and that for a few investigations, and I wasn't given that opportunity. And I don't know, I can't understand the logic behind that. Like, the offences that I was charged with and now convicted but subject to appeal, and this is not diminishing the need to follow rules, regulations or whatever, but I'm not this corrupt cop that's just bought shame, that should have just been ripped from the police force because he can't contribute anything further. Professionalism should have come into play, and put personal biases aside, I should have been able to do handovers on the investigations that I was working on. And I still speak to the victims. I still speak to the victims, and they reach out to me. I help them and advise them where I can, but obviously I'm outside the cops. But it's not a big ask. You know, if a loved one's been murdered, what do you expect from the cops? The cops have got to be invested in it. If they can't invest in it, they shouldn't be in homicide. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I know I'm not the first, and I won't be the last person to express such deep disappointment at your being removed, just because it's such a loss to victims and victims' families. I know other detectives are passionate as well, but it's just such a needless loss, you know?
Yeah, and look, there's a lot better detectives than I am in all the police forces across the country. I just hope this doesn't make people think, oh, well, look what happened to that bloke because he put out that he cared. Because you should care if you're investigating the crime. And there are some great detectives out there. And, you know, I've got a profile just because of the jobs that I was heading up. But the jobs I was heading up, there was a team working with me, beside me the whole way through. And there's some great people out there. But I just hope organisations don't drown people that want to go that little bit above and beyond. Because I don't think we should be in the police, and especially in homicide, striving for mediocrity. I think we really should be trying to make a difference.
Yeah, and I wouldn't think there are ever enough great detectives that we can afford to be throwing them away.
Yeah, look, I had the experience, you know, investigating homicides for 25 years. I still had the energy and I still had the passion, and I get on with my life outside the cops. I have a great life outside the cops, but that was my passion, and I felt that I could still contribute greatly, and that's the shame of the situation I found myself in.
Can I ask you the obvious question about the William Tyrrell investigation? I think it's obvious, but it's probably my naive faith in the police, but do you think you know what happened, but you just have not been able to sort of put the brief together? That's always my assumption in these situations. I always feel like, oh, I bet he knows. I bet he knows, and he just hasn't been able to pull it together yet.
I have case theories, and there's no one person that I can say definitively, I know this person was involved in William's abduction or has knowledge of it. But, I led the investigation for 4 years. It'd be a bit stupid of me to say I've got no idea, because obviously there's lines of inquiry. These lines of inquiry, and at the time of my removal, they were to be explored at inquest, and that was part of the process I was involved in. right up until the dramatic day that I was told not to speak to anyone about the William Tyrrell matter again, including the victim's family, which I felt that just seemed inconceivable. But look, there are, and I say case theories because they are only theories and they need to be tested quite rightly in courts or through the inquest. I'm also mindful that there's a current inquest and I don't want to usurp the authority of the coroner that's overseen the matter. So perhaps the clearest or strongest I can say is, look, I've got some ideas. I can't say with certainty, but then certainly more work needs to be done. And I'm sure it is being done. I don't think there's a police officer that doesn't want to see the William Tyrrell matter solved. It's just that it's going to be a tough one.
If your appeal is successful, could you go back to the cops? Would you go back?
Look, I can't see that I could go back. I don't think in the, there. But even if I could, after what's happened to me, as much as I love being a police officer, absolutely love it. It rocked my boat. I don't think I would go back because I couldn't trust that this wouldn't happen to me again.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could. I'd be worried that my mere presence or involvement in the matter would hinder the investigation for the victims because the cops might take a chop at me. So I wouldn't have the confidence to go back and work the way I need to work to solve homicides. So long and the short of it, even if I could, I wouldn't go back. And I'm sad about that, but that's the reality.
Could we talk about relationships that you develop with perpetrators? I know that that is not unheard of. It's not uncommon for you to develop relationships and keep them going. And certainly in your book and in your podcast, you've talked about an informant, Mr. X, whom you've developed a relationship with, whether you like it or not. And so,
interesting character.
Yeah. I'd love to know more about that. So can you talk to us about those situations? Charlie Vezina is one of our faves. He's a beautiful former homicide detective here in Melbourne. And he in particular developed quite a relationship with the man who was a bouncer and who had an altercation with cricket commentator David Hooks.
Right.
That led to David Hooks dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that man was acquitted on a manslaughter charge. But Charlie had an ongoing sort of relationship with that young man and his dad. You know, that can happen, can't it?
It can happen. And I think, and you've referenced Charlie, who I've got the utmost respect for and haven't worked with him, but my observation of the way he's gone about his business. And it doesn't surprise me that a detective like that has formed a relationship, because one of the things that I've found, and I've spoken to a lot of people I know as retired detectives, but also on the podcast that I'm doing, is about empathy. And speaking to Charlie, and I have spoken to him, something that struck me with Charlie is that he does have genuine empathy, and empathy leads to making that human connection between offenders, victims, witnesses, informants. That is something that human nature, people want to make that connection. So the longer you stay in the cops, and well, this is what this has done to me, it stopped me being judgmental. Like I see in every bad person, there's a little bit of good, and in good people, there's a little bit of bad. And so if you have that open mind to the people you're speaking to, I think that comes across and then they can relate to you. So it doesn't surprise me, but my relationships with informants and some of the big jobs that I've done, I've relied heavily on criminal informants. And what we're talking there is someone with a criminal history that is assisting police. Their credibility starts at ground zero as far as I'm concerned. They've got to prove themselves to me, like they're confirmed criminals and they're providing information. So I look at what's the motive, why are they providing this information? And that could be a lot of different reasons. It might be to get benefits on sentencing on a matter they might have before the court for monetary gain. And on the rare occasions, just because it's the right thing to do. You've got to look at their motive and then assess their evidence. I get the information from them. When I'm dealing with informants, the exchange of information is one way. They give me information, I don't give them information, because that's because I don't trust them. But if they continue to show that the information they've provided, I give them a little bit more respect, and that you get a relationship formed. But you've also got to be mindful, and you've got to have a strong moral compass when dealing with informants, because some of them can be quite charismatic and entertaining, and
yeah,
they're interesting people, and you've got to make sure that you don't compromise yourself. And I'm comfortable in saying I've never compromised myself dealing with informants, but I've solved a lot of cases because of my relationship with the informants.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I've spoken a lot about how it is that drug squads so often end up in trouble. Yeah. and oftentimes that sort of explanation is offered to me about how charismatic the informants are, how much fun they can be, you know. And before you know it, it's sort of things cross lines and...
Yeah, you're quite right. And that's where you've always got to, even if they're entertaining you with outrageous stories, you've also always got to just think, okay, I'm the police officer, you're the informant, and make sure you keep that relationship clearly defined.
Yeah, we're not friends.
Yeah.
I love your podcast. I love your book. And your work, your media work, has an energy that I haven't encountered with former police and their books and stuff. And now thinking about it, I think it's probably just because you're so young, and that's the great tragedy of it. Like, usually retired police are just not of your generation, and you shouldn't be writing this stuff yet, and you shouldn't be reflecting on your career yet. And that's what's so fucked about it, to be honest.
Well, that's a very, very good way of describing it. But no, look, I think it is the case. Like, if this didn't happen to me, I would have hung in there until I basically burnt myself out in policing, and they've sort of, policing's been ripped from me, but I've got all this energy and I want to channel it in some areas. So thanks very much for those comments. That's very nice of you to say.
Listening to your podcast, listening to you talk to other coppers is just so energetic and so exciting, and I still get this youthful exuberance and excitement about being a copper. I love that. And I think, yes, I want to be in the stick-ups.
Yeah, well, I look, if anything, I think sitting down listening to the police reflecting back on their careers, there is tragedy, there's sadness, and people, you know, always give compliments to the job that police do. But there is also the fun side of it. And some people might call it the black comedy or the way that we look at things. But I look back and I don't want to be pissed off and just angry at the cops. Like, I love my time in the cops, and I love talking to cops. I love the world of policing, and yeah, making those comments to me, I really appreciate it. Thanks very much, because I enjoy your stuff as well, and you seem to extract that side of policing out, understanding what it's all about.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, congratulations. It's good. It's great that you've found this niche for yourself where you can still enjoy the cops in a different way.
Yeah.
It's been 3 years now since Gary Jubelin's determination paid off for Mark and Faye Leveson, and he led the team that found the remains of their son Matthew in Sydney's Royal National Park. They'd been looking for a decade by then. I caught up with them today to check in and also to ask them about the bond they share with Gary Jubelin.
He's stolen a part of our heart. Well, we consider him family now.
You know, how long did it take you to develop this relationship with him?
Well, when we first met him, when we went in the meeting, and I was excited that Gary was there for the fact of his reputation. And, you know, we sat down with the three of them and talked. And then he was going on a 12-month sabbatical. And for that 12 months, we didn't get much back at all. We emailed and phoned, and there was no real communication there. And when he came back, he rang us and we had another meeting with him, and then things happened with the false
lead
and that. And he was really approachable, and, you know, we just started to think, well, we're going to get somewhere with this. And of course he didn't trust us at first, which is understandable, and that he sort of just told us little bits and pieces what was going on, but he was, you know, he thought that they were on the right trail. He was dogged. He was like a dog with a bone, and he just took off with that from there. But he's just, his communication skills, he was always professional as well, but he had the empathy there as well. And you felt that, you know, he said we could contact him anytime, which we tried not to, because, you know, they've got to have their time off too. But, you know, we'd have information, and there was just great communication between us, and he pulled together a really good team who we felt relaxed with, if that's the word. We knew that we're in good hands. It was just a matter of getting that person to open up as to what happened to Maddie.
Unfortunately, you were pretty experienced by that stage in dealing with the police, weren't you? I mean, how many years had it been since Maddie had disappeared when you started working with Gary like that?
Oh, I think it was in 2013. Yeah.
6 years?
6 years, yeah. 6 years of not knowing, and even when he started, still not knowing. but at least we had the sense that somebody was at last listening to us and going to do something about it. Because we were just knocking on doors, and every time we had information, we go down to Miranda and they didn't want to know. They fob you off. They wouldn't even bother replying half the time.
That's what I said to him. I said, you're that guy, whenever you're dealing with a huge institution, you know, and you just get ping-ponged around everywhere, you just need that one person who stops and says, okay, I'm going to take responsibility for you and I'm going to do what needs to be done for you. And he was that guy, right?
He was that guy, yeah, exactly. And, you know, nothing was ever a problem to him. He was down at the site with us most of the time. He was doing whatever, getting his hands dirty. He wasn't just sitting back on his laurels, even though he had Scott in charge, and Scott did a fantastic job, and the others, Damien and John. And, you know, they all work well together. And it just, you know, you needed somebody like Gary as well to, I don't know, is it because of his reputation, his experience, he pulled together a good team, and it just made things a whole lot easier for us and the family.
Now, do I remember correctly, did you take that fern home? Is that right?
Yeah, we took the palm home, yeah.
You did?
Yeah, we did. It's looking very sad. It's still in its pot. Mark's laughing here. I mean, it's brown, and but it's still in the pot, and it hasn't deteriorated anymore. It hasn't got any greenery on it. But anyway, it's Matty. That palm is Matt. He nourished that palm. And if it wasn't for Mitch and Scott, we'd be still looking for Maddie, and of course Gary saying we'd had to go down there again and just cross hatch where they'd been. So when it went back to court, the Atkins defence couldn't say, well, you know, Maddie could be in between where the buckets missed.
That's right, because his deal was contingent upon him leading the police to Maddie. So yeah, the deal would have been off, right, if they hadn't found him.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I mean, when Mitch and Scott said to Mitch, take the palm out, and he did, well, you know, we were packing up. And
unbelievable.
Yeah. I still remember when Gary called us over, because they'd stopped before and they'd found echidna bones or something that wasn't related. And I just said no. No, I couldn't believe it. And I think part of me was saying no because I didn't want it to be true, because then I had to come to the realisation that he was dead, even though we knew he was dead. That finalised it.
So what have the last couple of years been like for you guys? That was 10 years of your life, was looking for Maddie and dealing with the bureaucracy of New South Wales Police and all of that. And so to have that one thing that you asked Gary Jubelin for in the end, when he asked you to narrow it down to one thing, and you did, and you said, we want Maddie's remains, we want to bring him home, and you achieved that. So that was 3 years ago now?
Yeah, 31st of May 17.
Yeah. What's life been like since then?
A roller coaster. You never get over it. I mean, it's good. We've got Maddie home. He's in our dining room. The boys, we didn't want him in the ground. We wanted him home with him. He'd spent long enough out there by himself. It's just been a roller coaster of emotions. Every time you hear about bones, even now, other remains being found, and we've got a lot of good friends who've got people missing, your heart breaks for them as well, and it brings everything back to the fore for us, what we went through. You never get over it. You can't describe to people how it makes you feel, how it's devastated our lives. And in the same time, we feel lucky, if that's the word, that we've got him home, but it's still living hell. And then to turn around and to do that to Gary, the detective, then in the middle of our case, they put him on the Tyrrell case, and we're sort of I'm thinking selfishly, oh, my God, he's not going to put his efforts into Maddie, which was far from the truth, because he did. He did. He never, our case never neglected, wasn't neglected. But he just seems to be the guy that every time there was a hard case and they couldn't crack it, oh, we'll give it to Gary Jubelin. He can handle it. He can do it. And so they were spreading him thin, and then they turn around and do that to him. And there's so many conspiracy theories out there why they did that to Gary, but the way we see it is it was just tall poppy syndrome, a witch hunt, jealousy, and it's a boys' club. Even to the fact they tried to bring us into it, bring Mark into it, because there was a recording of Mark's voice on Gary's phone. And you could see it in their eyes, rubbing their hands, oh, we've got him on this one, until Mark said, yeah, I knew it was at my suggestion. And the look on their faces was classic.
Thank you, Gary Jubelin, for joining us on the show. And thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. Made in association with the Acast Creator Network. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.